Good afternoon. Welcome to the Modern Art Museum of Fort Worth. Welcome to Sundays with the Modern. This is our tour program where we invite artists, writers, curators, and other art world figures to talk about works on view and special exhibitions in the collection. Next month, we're going to feature Thomas Fulmer, who will talk about this exhibition, Glenn Ligon America, on April 1st. But today, it's my pleasure to introduce David Wilburn. He's the gallery director and a professor at Eastfield College. He earned his bachelor's from the Vermont College of Norwich University and an MFA from the Vermont College of Fine Arts. His work's been featured in exhibitions at 500X Gallery in Dallas, the University of Art and Design in Helsinki, the Museum of Arts and Design in New York, and the Museum of Contemporary Craft in Portland, Oregon. Most recently, you might have seen his work in Town and Country at Branton Art Space here in Fort Worth, or in last year's solo exhibition called The Overuse of Everything at the Dallas Contemporary. This past fall, he co-curated with Noah Symblist an exhibition called Queer States at the Visual Arts Center of UT Austin. It explored the ways in which Texas artists queered gender identity and the performance of sexuality through visual representation. The exhibition examined how artists participate in the performance of queer bodies and included video, performance, photography, painting, and sculpture. It has been reviewed to high acclaim. Please join me in welcoming David Wilburn.
Thank you. Thanks so much. I think that was the first time I have been applauded as an art world figure, which sounds like something much greater than I think I actually am. I think of myself as an artist who also teaches and occasionally organizes exhibitions that are at least engaging, if not radical. So thank you for being here today. My plan is to engage you in a conversation about this exhibition, because I think, and really not just one conversation, I think there are myriad conversations taking place in this show or that could be had with regard to this exhibition. So we can kind of move this way as I look at my copious notes and prepare to talk about the first body of works. So as you heard Leslie say in my introduction, especially at the end of the introduction when she talked about Queer States, which was, I feel like, a really wonderful exhibition that I was very happy to have participated in, because I think throughout my own life, and definitely throughout my studio practice as an artist, and in my engagement with Noah Symblist about Queer States, I have most often been concerned with notions of identity. What does it mean to perform one's self? What does it mean for me to wake up every morning as a man, as a white man, as a gay white man, as a gay white male artist, as a Texan, as an American? You know, we make specific choices about our identity, and especially how we perform it each and every day. And so that is one of the many reasons why I am thrilled to participate in this conversation with you today, because this exhibition, I think, I hope that you agree at the end of this talk, is really entirely about identity. It's about multiple identities, and it's about questions of identity, and can we separate them? Can we separate who we are as a woman, as a mother, as a teacher, etc.? Or do we always have to view them together? I want to start, though, with something that I think, this is a curious exhibition for me, because there's so much happening in it, so much happening socially as well as politically. And I think Mr. Ligon is equally a kind of a curious figure. You know, he grew up in housing projects in the Bronx. He attended the Walden School, which is a very prestigious private academy, mostly white private academy. But it was dedicated to sort of progressive principles in education. And then he went to the Wesleyan University in Connecticut, where he became a painter who focused primarily on his interest in abstract expressionism, which is why I want to start by talking with you about these numbered paintings, or what I often refer to as the dream interpretation paintings. If you look at these, and I don't know if you've had a chance to look at these close up yet, but I think this demonstrates the artist's early influence by the abstract expressionist movement and the artists of that particular movement, specifically artists like Franz Kline, Jackson Pollock, to a degree Mark Rothko, but I think Mark Rothko, and historians in the room, correct me, but I believe that Mark Rothko was less about abstract expressionism and a little more about color field painting. And when I look at these, I see that same kind of notion being explored. The abstract expressionists were very concerned with making a monumentally scaled paintings. For the most part, these aren't monumental, but another thing that the abstract expressionists were concerned with was really covering the entire space of the canvas, or the entire space of the page, with color or with marks. And that's what we see happening in the background of these pieces. We see in the background this sort of abstract expressionist reference, especially artists like Jackson Pollock or to a degree Mark Rothko. So we have this sort of, these paintings are in many ways, at least on the surface, about the interpretation of dreams. And the paint itself seems to be a little bit dreamy in a way, in how it is presented. It's kind of brushy. The colors are, for the most part, soft, somewhat calm in the background. And then in the foreground, we have these interpretations, and I don't know where these came from. I don't know where these interpretations were originally documented, but they read like sweetheart, to dream that your sweetheart whispers funny things in your ears is a sign of joy. To dream of numbers denotes wealth and happiness. I find that curious, but I also find it kind of threatening. Like, there, I question the idea that there is a documented text somewhere in the world that claims to interpret what I'm dreaming about, as though I have any ability to control what I dream about, like it's going to be a choice. Another interesting thing about these pieces is each one contains a number, and these numbers were part of, it was like an underground lottery system, and his father actually participated in these numbers games. He actually worked in what was called a numbers parlor. So after he would get off of his job in manufacturing, he would go and work for this underground numbers parlor. So I think that's where we have the connection here. In ways one could say that the dream interpretations are sort of by chance, just like the numbers game is. Now we're going to move back here to these text paintings. You're going to hear me say something like, "This is my favorite thing in the show," probably about five or six times, about five or six different works of art. And here's the first one. This panel right here, which is titled, actually it's untitled, and then parenthetically, the statement is, "I feel most colored when I'm thrown against a sharp white background." And in my notes, this piece is my favorite of the group for now. And actually, that text comes from an essay titled "How It Feels to Be Colored" by Zora Neale Hurston. And I just want to read you a little piece from from Hurston's text. Changes came in the family when I was 13, and I was sent to school in Jacksonville. I left Eatonville, the town of the Oleanders, Azora. When I disembarked from the riverboat at Jacksonville, she, Zora, was no more. It seemed that I had suffered a sea change. I was not Zora of Orange County anymore. I was now a little colored girl. I find it out in certain ways, in my heart as well as in the mirror. I became a fast brown, warranted not to rub nor run. And so thinking about that text, thinking about, you know, the idea of a young girl suddenly removing herself or being removed from the context of her home or of what is familiar or of the things and people and bodies that look like her, suddenly being placed in a totally different context. And context, I think, is really important to consider in this exhibition. Not just context, but recontextualizing something. And so Zora herself has sort of been recontextualized. Here she was surrounded by what felt like the norm, in her family, in a community that is predominantly black. And now she is in a different space, a different setting, a different situation, where she is surrounded by all of this contrast. And she, this is when and where and how she discovers that she is, in fact, African American. And I think this piece right here, and really all of these in this series, I think is really crucial because they really seem, for me anyway, to push that notion of identity. But identity contrasted against the identities of others. The notion of being the different one, the notion of being the other with a capital T and capital O. Another thing that attracts me to these panels is the fact that the text, you notice at the top, the text is at its sharpest, but it's really not that sharp. It's still kind of fuzzy. The edges are kind of blurry when we are confronted with text, when we're presented with text, we have certain expectations about how we view them or how well we can see them. You know, we want them to be relatively sharp because they're words that are stenciled or printed. But here, not so much. Even at the top, where it's easiest to read them, the text is kind of fuzzy, it's kind of grainy. And then as you move down the panel, it becomes increasingly difficult to identify the individual words, despite the fact that by the time we get down here, we are very familiar with the text because it's really the same line or the same sentence presented over and over. Another thing that attracts me to these pieces is the fact that I feel like these panels are most closely related to my own work as an artist. My work deals with notions of identity primarily as a gay man engaged in sort of daily domestic rituals, things that take place in and around the home, either with my partner or with my pet or, you know, with no one at all other than myself. But in these pieces, I most often leave the threads to hang. The edges of the fabric is often left untreated or untouched, left to in a sense kind of unravel, or at least imply that the entire thing is about to come apart, that it's unfinished, that it's unraveling. And I definitely get that same sense when I look at these panels, especially as you look at the text, which is kind of fuzzy, kind of grainy. And as you move down the panel itself, it becomes increasingly difficult. Also, another thing that I find really interesting in these pieces, and this is just sort of the art nerd in me that really has nothing to do with content or meaning, but actually, I take that back. I think it could have something to do with content or meaning. If you look closely at these panels, and one thing that I like to do when I look at a work of art, and it probably makes the gallery attendants nervous, is I like to get close enough to it so that I can see it from the side. And if you do that, or if you just get close up to these panels, you see this really wonderful and luscious texture that gives the piece a real weight, like a visual weight that implies a real kind of weight to them. And we actually are going to see more of that when we go into some of the other rooms, which we will do right now. We're actually going to come in here to the right. It's kind of awkward coming in here where there are people looking at the work who were not part of the tour, and I kind of feel bad for them, because they're probably thinking, this is not what I signed up for, and they run away. But I think there are multiple reasons to possibly run away from this room. One being the paintings and the text within the paintings. These paintings are based on the comedy, the stand-up comedy of Richard Pryor. Do you know who Richard Pryor is or was? If not, look him up. He's widely considered to be one of the most important, I would add most influential American comedians of the 20th century. He died, when did he die? Does anyone know? Richard Pryor died in, I want to say in early 2000s, 2005, something like that. But anyway, he was very important. He made a lot of people nervous. I would suggest that he made a lot of white people nervous, because he was an African-American comedian who was known for very political, sometimes incendiary or inflammatory statements about race and about the relationships between different races. And so that's what we see. If you look around, you can easily identify the language of Richard Pryor's sort of social and political commentary. And I think a lot of questions, and actually first let me start by saying these paintings are difficult to look at for a couple of reasons. One reason, perhaps the most obvious reason that you can tell from a distance, is the colors themselves. The colors themselves don't lend themselves to easy or comfortable viewing. If one of my studio art students were to present something using these colors, I think I would have a lot of questions. But actually, these colors I kind of like. And so the colors make it difficult. So that's like layer number one. And there are layers, multiple layers throughout this exhibition. Layer number two, and the bigger, perhaps scarier layer, is the language in the panels. So we have very colorful panels, difficult colorful panels, that contain equally difficult and colorful words and language. And I think something very interesting happens when I am here at the museum in this room. Really, in all of the rooms, oh gosh, especially this one, wait till we get there. But in this room, watching someone read the panel, literally read the painting. We're not used to, we're used to reading art, but that's mostly seeing art and sort of trying to understand in some way what the work means. But here we actually have to literally read the painting, because the painting contains text. And so I find it personally curious to watch someone read these paintings and then think about what is the picture forming in their heads? What are they thinking about? How are they considering their own notion, belief, idea about what these words mean? because it kind of implicates each individual viewer into some kind of understanding of this language. And it becomes kind of awkward. It becomes kind of awkward for me to stand in front of one of these paintings confronted with this language, knowing that I have very specific thoughts, memories, histories with some of these words. And someone else is watching me, perhaps wondering what those histories are. I want us to go into this next room right here, which is the room with my new favorite piece. And one thing that I forgot to mention in that previous room, looking at those paintings inspired by the comedy of Richard Pryor, but I think I can mention it in this room or any room, and that is so much of this work asks us questions. In fact, it asks us more questions than it provides us with answers, and I think that's a good thing. I think something really wonderful happens in the work of Glenn Ligon, and that is that he doesn't let us get away with any kind of easily knowable or understandable answer or interpretation of the work. But back to these Richard Pryor pieces, and I think a lot of things in this exhibition, is he's asking the questions, like, one of the questions would be, how do words become images? How do words create images? And we're actually going to talk about that question, how do words create images, even more when we get to his Red Portfolio, where he addresses the work of Robert Mapplethorpe. But first I want to talk about this Runaway series. These pieces right here are pretty fascinating and troubling at the same time, because what he did is he invited friends to write, Glenn Ligon invited friends to write descriptions of him as though they were placing a missing persons ad. And then he presents them as 18th and 19th century postings about runaway slaves. And he became very interested in those original runaway slave postings because of the often intimate details used by the slave owner to describe the slave. Like, you know, he can play, he knows how to play a musical instrument. He is not only this tall, but he's a wonderful cook. Ligon became interested in not only the knowing of those intimate details, but then the sharing of those intimate details to make the potential return of that individual even more seductive. And so here he invited his friends to write these descriptions, and then he presents them in equally curious detail, but the text in these pieces is about the artist. And I want to read some of the text, if I can find it. Oh, here it is. Some of the descriptions include, like, he is socially very adept. I'm talking about the artist. Yet, paradoxically, he is somewhat of a loner. Some of the text reads, he has cute eyebrows and a really cool Timex silver watch with a silver band. And so he's sort of toying with that same kind of descriptive language used by the slave owner. These pieces right here, these crates, are about the story or the legacy of Henry Brown, or he became known as Henry Box Brown. Henry Brown was a slave who worked with a sympathetic mill worker or carpenter who created a crate large enough for Henry Brown to fit in, and then he had himself mailed to a more progressive state where he could be free. And I find it really interesting because the one thing, and this comes from Ligon himself, the one thing that Henry Brown could not do was make noise. He couldn't speak, he couldn't cry out, he couldn't verbalize any discomfort throughout this journey that was, I think the journey was like something like 24 hours. So it was 24 hours he spent not just in a box, but in a box that is moving and traveling and who knows how it was handled or treated. But here, in the hands of Glenn Ligon, he has, in a way, given these boxes their own individual and unique voices. And these voices are, they seem to be addressing the complexities that that he considers to be sort of the complex history, African-American history, in the United States. Because some of them, you know, we have some of these boxes that contain voices singing about, I forget the title of this song right here, Strange Fruit. Others are more contemporary voices sort of addressing contemporary issues of being black, specifically being black and male in the United States. Now we're going to move to this room. I want us to look at this painting right here, which is titled, untitled actually, untitled and then in parentheses, conclusions. This, like so many pieces in this exhibition, is really, it's about identity, but it's about the identity of the other or of being or becoming the other. This comes from an essay by the author James Baldwin, who was also a black gay man. And so those are the three of the identities or issues that Glenn Ligon is addressing throughout his work. But in this story, in this particular essay, not a story, but an essay where he addresses the fact that upon the invitation from his then lover, he was invited to a small town in Switzerland, and I do not know the name of that small town, but he was pretty much the only black man that the villagers in that town have ever seen, most of them anyway. And so I find it really curious because for me, this sort of like takes me back throughout my entire history. It takes me back to my personal history of being a student at Monterey High School in Lubbock, Texas. And I don't know if you know anything about Lubbock, Texas, but it has been documented that it is, I think, the second most conservative city in the United States. And so, you know, something like this becomes very personal to me because it gives me a chance to view it in a way that many others cannot. You know, we can all view this and we can all think about it and we can think about the story, the text, and possibly even imagine some sort of personal connection based on our own personal stories. But for me, this becomes a trigger for something else. And so I get to kind of think about what both Glenn Ligon and James Baldwin might have thought about. You know, what does it mean to be the only one viewed as different, viewed as unlike? You know, and I can't say that James Baldwin was treated by the Swiss in the same way that I was treated by the Lubbockites. I hope not. I certainly hope he wasn't. But I think that's something, looking at this show, and hopefully after this talk, you can spend a little more time with it is go back and look at some of these pieces and imagine, if you can, how they may or may not trigger personal memories. You know, because I think that is something that can kind of help you get further into an exhibition that is as complicated and multi-layered and cannot possibly be addressed in the context of one talk by one now sort of sweaty artist. Having shared that detail, I'm really not that sweaty. Let's move into the next room. Okay, new favorite pieces, these three right here. And again, this is the art nerd in me coming out, but the reason why I like these pieces so much is because they are printed, images printed on unstretched canvases that are then pinned to the wall with what, to me at least, what looks, yeah, literally push-pinned to the wall. Now, I love walking into an art museum, especially a world-class institution like this one, that appears to have its own kinds of aesthetic rules about how you display something on the wall, and seeing an unstretched canvas tacked to the wall. It for me, it gives the work a sense of honesty, a sense of immediacy about it. It also, I think that the way that these works are presented references the information that the works actually contain. These pieces, these three, this one back here with all of the hands, this one right here with that wonderful large, seemingly blank banner, this one right here with the Capitol Dome and the monitor, they're all from images from the Million Man March that Glenn Ligon did not attend. He, like many of us, viewed the Million Man March through the eyes of the media, which is interesting because then it's like we're viewing it as it is being filtered for us, and so we're receiving only sound bites, bits and pieces, reflections of information. These images, again, they were culled from media images, and they seem to have been distorted, especially this one right here. The image, this piece, seems to have been distorted through the process of getting it on the unstretched canvas that included enlarging the piece, copying it multiple times. In fact, it looks like the kind of image that has been run through a copier multiple times over and over, each time it's run through that copier or each time an image is printed or even displayed, it loses some integrity, it loses some of the detail, it becomes fuzzier, it becomes grainier, which I think connects us right back to some of those text paintings that we looked in the very first room, that we looked at in the very first room. The information is not clear. It is vague at best. And then that's something that we see in these pieces. they seem somewhat vague. A question that came to my mind is, do these pieces in any way convey a sense of the confusion or the ambivalence the artist had towards the march itself, which was a march viewed, again, by Ligon, removed through media imagery? Or do they speak to, in any way, these three pieces, do they speak to a larger notion of cultural memory? Because this is something that, an event that was shared really by an entire nation, but primarily meant to be shared by African American men. And so do these images reflect that kind of shared memory, that that cultural memory? These pieces right here, these self-portrait pieces, They're really confrontational for me, despite the fact that he is not looking at me. And I think that's intentional, and I think that's probably the most interesting part of these self-portrait prints. Because clearly, he's presenting himself in the context of a mugshot, right? But unlike a typical mugshot, he's not looking at us. So he is embracing, he is acknowledging that mugshot image history, but he is also confronting it at the same time by not looking at the camera. At best, we see him in profile. But